Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. Eating disorders are a complex group of conditions that have a devastating impact on individuals and families. Eating disorders thrive in isolation and feed on shame, leading a person down a road of chronic mental and physical health problems. So just what are eating disorders? How prevalent are they? Are there good treatment options in our community? And what should you do if you are concerned that a person you care about might be struggling with an eating disorder? Well, joining me today for today's conversation are Beth Rose and Dr. Laura Hill. Beth is the board chair and a co-founder of the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance. She has also served as assistant vice chancellor for development for the University of Alaska Anchorage, executive director for Alaska Junior Theater, and as the communications director for the Alaska Humanities Forum. Dr. Laura Hill is an international eating disorder consultant focusing on brain-based eating disorder treatment approaches. She is an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral health at The Ohio State University and an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry, the University of California at San Diego. Dr. Hill is one of the original founders of the Academy for Eating Disorders, which is now known as the National Eating Disorders Alliance. She is also the founder and former president and chief executive officer of the Center for Balanced Living. Welcome to the program. I appreciate you both for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
It's a pleasure, Prentice.
And where are you calling us from, Dr. Hill?
I'm literally standing in a cornfield in Ohio. So I'm right now in Ohio.
All right. Well, welcome. Okay, if you have a question for my guest today or a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to join in on the conversation. We can be reached in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Our toll-free number from anywhere else you might be listening is 1-888-353-5752. And the last way you can participate today is to email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. All right. I guess before we get started on our topic, let's go ahead and start with Dr. Hill. Can you, I guess, talk briefly about your experience in the field of eating disorders and why you chose this work as your sort of lifetime passion?
Sure. I began this area in focus in 1979, before eating disorders were even a formal diagnosis. I was directing a counseling center at a university and had my master's degree and was seeing more and more students with eating problems, and I was failing miserably in my treatment. Now, I have a couple traits that have been truly to my benefit, even though they can at times be a little offsetting. And one is highly determined and one is very stubborn. And so I found myself taking these notes of what might be going on. Is this a social pressure issue around body shape? Is this brain-based? Is this family-based? So then I went back to interview for a doctorate to learn more about these problems, which is when the diagnosis was act during the time of which the diagnosis became formulated, and interviewed and said, I want courses in these topics so that I can study this area more. What degree do I need? They let me know, and the rest is history. And so I've been focusing and evolving in our research, treatment, and the dissemination of what we know as science is evolving for the last 40 years.
And your focus is really on the neurobiological component. And you really are, like sort of locking down and centering on the science and the brain stuff behind it, right?
That is exactly right, Curtis. And in the first 30 years of the diagnosis, the science was not pointing in that direction because we didn't
Dr. Hill, I think we've lost you in the cornfield. you're having a bad reception. So we'll get back to that in just a second, but I'll move on to Beth and see if my crack team in there can figure out how to get that connection back a little better. So Beth, can you give us a little bit about your background and what you folks are doing over where you're at?
Sounds good. Thank you, Prentice. Well, my background is I have a background in nonprofit management and communications and community engagement, and had not planned to enter this field. As you mentioned, I'm the co-founder of this organization, and I had an eating disorder when I was a teenager and survived and went on to have full recovery. And later, I would have left that in the rearview mirror, but later supported a loved one with an eating disorder, a family member, and found it incredibly difficult to find treatment, support, connect with others, especially because there's nothing beyond outpatient care here. If you can find a therapist once a week, if
it's
you can
hard.
Find a dietitian. And I happened to find out that somebody who I'd spent probably 15 years in a book club with, Jenny Loudon, my other co-founder, was in the same boat. But because of what you mentioned, the shame and isolation around this illness, we never talked about it. So we met each other in a parent support group online, a Facebook support group online.
And they're like, hey, I know you.
Exactly. This is a club that nobody wants to belong to, and nobody talks about it. And Jenny and I came together and said, we've learned a lot. There is so much isolation where there really shouldn't be around an all-too-common illness. There's not enough knowledge about this in Alaska. There's not enough treatment in Alaska. And we wanted to form a nonprofit to address this issue because nothing else existed. So we didn't want others to have to walk this journey alone. And we're celebrating, the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance, or AKEDA, is celebrating 3 years today. And not today, but this month. And so we're focused on education, support, and advocacy. And those are the main areas that we're focused on. And I can tell you a bit more about those if you want, or if we can wait.
We will get into those when we talk about resources towards the latter part of the show. I'd really like to dig into some of the things that are going on because you have a whole list of exciting trainings and resources that are available for folks who are struggling with this and family members, which I think is great. I've had you all on, this is the third time. I think the first time must have been right after you started.
I think it was like in January or something like that after we started. So a few months. But we came together, and I'll tell you, we have a dream board. We have folks from around Alaska. We're a statewide organization. But our board kind of represents an ideal treatment team. So we have a doctor. We have a psychiatrist. We have a couple of therapists. We have a dietitian. We have people with lived experience. We have a wellness coach. Jenny and I have masters of public administration, so we bring that management approach as well as lived experience. So people wanted to see this exist and be successful.
Yeah, because there was really nothing in the community, or very little. A few people were doing it privately.
Yeah.
And that was really about it. And I remember sending lots of young females particularly out of state to treatment centers, Utah, Colorado, places like that.
Right.
And we don't have any treatment center here, correct?
That is correct. There's nothing beyond outpatient care. So if you need hospitalization for eating disorders or residential care, you have to go outside if you have insurance or if you can afford it any other way. And it's huge cost to do that personally, to leave your job, to leave your family, to go with a loved one outside.
All right. Do we have Dr. Hill back, I think?
You sure do.
All right. That was very strange. You just started like chopping up.
Oh.
It sounds
usually
like
the field has usually this field has better reception than my home, so sorry about that.
Well, that's no problem. It happens quite often when we have calls, so we just roll with it.
Okay.
All right. So, Beth, I guess, well, let's go ahead and talk about, quickly, because we don't want to miss it, some of the training opportunities that actually that we were just sort of mentioning that I said we'd get to later, but now I want to get to them now.
Great. Sounds good.
So let's get those out of the way and talk about the slate of things that you have coming up.
And I guess I should say that to give some context to the slate, one of the we really do focus on education with a major focus on training providers, because one of our goals is to increase the capacity of medical and mental health providers in the state to address this issue. And we don't expect people to become specialists. We're too small a market to have a whole bunch of specialists. We want more people to know eating disorders exist. What are they? We want them to know that there's treatment options, that there's recovery is possible. So we're really doing a lot to grow that capacity to address this issue. And we also have programs for those providing support. And then we do community awareness. So those are in the category of education. So I wanted to give a little framework for that. And as you mentioned, we have a lot going on. We got a grant, Alaska Nonprofit Recovery Fund grant, to address health issues that were really impacted by COVID, and eating disorders have skyrocketed as a result. So these ones are really addressing eating disorders in our state. We will get into all of the activities we'll have with Dr. Laura Hill, but I will just have to mention that it's a treat. It's a privilege to have her come to Alaska, because she's so nationally and internationally renowned. And she will be in this trip. We will have her come back in 2023 for more intense training. But on this trip, she will be providing a series of lunch and learns for medical and mental health providers. And really, in an exciting way, she'll also be providing 3-hour trainings for people who are providing support for loved ones. And this will be in Anchorage, Palmer, Sitka, and Juneau, or actually I should say it's in Juneau for Southeast Alaska, and online. And that will be for people who are supporting loved ones of any type of eating disorder, any age. So she'll talk about that. We have, starting tonight, September 7th, a 6-week series on eating disorders, Project Echoes, and that's it's an online program that Akita is doing with the UAA Center for Human Development, and we have local and national experts on eating disorders. So they will be covering a range of topics, from understanding eating disorders as diseases of disconnection, to identifying eating disorders across a lifespan, medical management, and more. And there's up to 9 free CMEs and CEUs for providers, so completely free. It's a foundational course, if you will, and it's after work, so it's 6 to 7:30 in the evening. So after your people are done with their clients, we hope, or their patients, they can attend this.
Right. We should be done at that time. Okay. All right, so that's and those are free, and they are. I saw that it was the LCSW board; they're approved, and
they all are approved through AHAC.
So. All right, that's a good opportunity for free CEUs, as we all need them when we can find them. All right, so Dr. Hill, I asked before you sort of broke up can you talk a little bit about. Or were we done there? I don't
know. I actually have just a couple more.
I get to. I just like jumped ahead. Yeah.
Well, I'll just share a couple more Dr. Hill works, has done this research with UC San Diego, University of California, San Diego, and we're working with them to provide training. It's a self-paced training for parents with children and teens who are experiencing anorexia, any kind of restrictive eating disorder. And to complement that and to break down the isolation that we talked about, we'll have some parent support and discussion group. So that's going on. There's an on-demand eating disorder boot camp. I'll just say that all of these, we have so many opportunities right now for getting support, for learning, whether you're a professional or whether you need support as an individual or as a parent. You can find out a lot of information on our website, and that's at akeatingdisorders.org you can go /workshops, and you can see all the workshops that are going on.
Yeah, that link is on our show page on Alaska Public Media, but can you just mention that, your website, one more time?
Yes.
So people can log on there. It's got all these things listed.
It's got everything. So it's AK, Eating Disorders, with an S, eatingdisordersalliance.org.
All right, great. Okay, so I got excited and got ahead of myself. So Dr. Hill, back to you. Can you talk a little bit about some of the work you're doing from a brain perspective, the neurobiological and sort of genetic underpinnings of eating disorders, and what's being learned about that?
You bet. For the first 30 years of eating disorders being diagnosed since 1980, what we realized is that that it is not primarily an outside-in or social pressure to be thin driven illness. It's not a social illness in many ways. There are people that may be influenced. Everyone diets maybe for various social reasons, but the fact that we began to realize is when the technology changed, Prentice, and that is the beginning of 2000 forward. And in these last 20 years, once the genome was sequenced in 2000 and the equipment, technology equipment began to be refined, we could not only do an MRI, like a slice of the brain in 1 second, but suddenly we could do an fMRI, which is being able to put someone in the scanner, maybe have them drink a milkshake or drink a particular solution that's tasty, and watch what their brain does while they are digesting it and dealing with it. And you can therefore see how the brain registers hunger, satisfaction to what they're eating, when it starts to register fullness. And what the people at colleagues at UC San Diego did is they looked at people who don't have an eating disorder to see how a healthy brain shows and responds to these conditions. And then they compared them with people who have eating disorders such as anorexia nervosa. And then what they saw were incredible differences, significant differences. And they were seeing them by from person to person, and across a trend. And so the first paper that came out that was cornerstone was in 2006, and that showed how the circuits were firing differently. And then from there, it has continued to grow. Now, when an infant is conceived, that genome, half from the one parent and half from the other, literally starts to formulate and structure the brain on how it's going to have its general structure, just as you would say a maple tree is never going to be the same as a pine tree. The genetic structure is already formulated, and from the time it starts to evolve from that seed, it's going to be a different tree. We know that that genetic influence on human development is the same, and our traits, our personality traits, literally are identified or formulated in that genetic makeup, and then the brain literally starts during fetal development to start structuring how those traits are going to be expressed initially, and then once the infant is born, obviously, it's how the wind blows, it's how many storms that person experiences in their life, just like it is with trees. And so the environment certainly shapes those traits, but the traits are there, and that is our gift, and that's our nemesis at times. And so what we began to realize is how trait-based certain traits appear to show increased vulnerability, that when they are combined, they develop into somebody who's going to be much more vulnerable to developing an eating disorder, either and even moving towards where a person tends to cope with food by not eating and being more anorexia, to coping with food by binge eating and being more bulimia and or binge eating disorders. And those traits come through, the symptoms come through because of impulsive traits moving towards a binge eating perspective or towards avoidant or inhibited traits, which trigger or set up the basis for those with anorexia. And then in addition to those traits and the structure and expression that they have, if there are some neuro brain circuit aberrations, such as we are finding an area in the brain called the insula that is kind of the hub for gathering all the sensations that you and I experience. If your gut is telling you you're hungry, the message has to go through the insula in order to inform the front of your brain how to make a decision. So if I sense hunger, I then decide to eat. And then there's a circuit that says, oh, that tastes good. So I get this spike in dopamine, and then that tells me I like it, I'll have another bite. What we discovered from 2006 forward is the more we started looking at it, those with anorexia were not getting some of those signals. Some weren't getting them at all. They could not tell at all if they were hungry or full, and they did not get signals of reward or pleasure. So they neither could know when to eat, how much to eat, or got any pleasure from it. So it became quite easy just to avoid food. And they would typically say, I feel great if I'm not eating. Why are you telling me to eat? And so we used to, in the old outside-in model, we would say, you're just trying to lose weight. You're trying to convince yourself. You're just afraid of growing up. There were so many theories out there, and they're truly farther away from the truth, because the truth is they couldn't see or sense the hunger, the signals to respond, and they didn't have the traits that helped them move forward in some cases. The wonderful thing is they also had traits that were often highly determined and stubborn and optimistic, and those traits help them, when they realize they have them, become part of their armor to fight and move and reshape the traits that have moved towards something more destructively, because all of our traits move from a productive to a destructive expression at any time in our life. You may say, I have a tendency to speak out and to impulsively say things. Well, that can be incredibly good if you're buying stocks and you're well-educated. It could be very bad if you're in a situation where listening is primary. So how we use our traits more attentively became the focus of what our treatment development was and how we understand those neurobiological abnormalities became literally what we began to describe to our clients. And when they began to hear it, Prentice, it was probably one of the most turning points of my career. I was seeing improvements in treatment, but not a lot. And then suddenly when I'm daring to explain the research that we were starting to discover, client after client began to break down in tears in my office and would say, Dr. Hill, you've just totally described me. I never knew how to say that. And then I'd think, oh, this is just this client. Wait till I talk to this client. And then the client would break down and say, that's it, Dr. Hill. Now, I can tell hunger, but I have no idea how to, I have no sense of fullness. So then we began to realize how the neurocircuits were varied for every client. So we needed to start asking them, which we never did before. We never said, can you sense hunger? Can you sense fullness? Now we have it on our assessment instruments that we utilize to help all clinicians know what to ask and then to help them with how to explain it to their clients. And it became a game changer in that the clients themselves began to say, tell me more, and then I'd go back and read more, and then I worked with my research team, and they continued to lead the way. Dr. Kay and Dr. Waringa literally led the way in providing more and more research to explain the illness from the inside out instead of the outside in. And as a result, it's kind of like wearing glasses. I don't think, none of us think twice if we have, if we're farsighted. That means we need to read readers. We need to have glasses to compensate, to make up for those retinal responses that are not firing clearly. And we all know that it's a retinal neuron problem that glasses can correct for externally. Well, that's where we are in this treatment. We know that they are, there are neurobiological aberrations in the insula, in the ventral striatal tract, and a couple other areas. We know they're there, but we don't yet have insular glasses to help the client get a clear sense if they're hungry or not. So we have to compensate with glasses, and the glasses are external. And that may be a support person, that's the external compensation, or it may be a structure that the client says, I've got to put a structure together, because if I don't eat at regular times, then suddenly I am so hungry and I get a signal, but it's so extreme I have no control over it.
All right. So, I gotta interrupt you for a second. I'm just listening and it's fascinating. And it seems like the more that we learn about the brain, maybe the less that mothers will get blamed for everybody's problems, right? Like that there's a lot of inherent stuff that we're born with, and it does get shaped by our environment. But I am up against, or I'm way past my break, and I forgot to mention one thing that I am obligated to mention is that Beth is a board member at Alaska Public Media, which she does not have that hat on today, but we have to let people know that she is part of our community here. But so thanks for doing that. And
yeah, absolutely. And as you said, I'm here with a whole different hat on today.
Whole different hat. All right. If you're just tuning in today, my guests are Beth Rose from the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance and international eating disorder consultant Dr. Laura Hill. We are discussing the causes, consequences, and some of the groundbreaking treatments that are evolving for eating disorders. If you have a question for my guests or a comment about today's topic, please join us. Anchorage, our number is 907-550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we will return for more of our conversation. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us today, my guests are Beth Rose from the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance and international eating disorders consultant, Dr. Laura Hill. We are discussing eating disorders and some of the new treatment options that are sort of evolving, which Dr. Hill was enlightening us about earlier, and it was fascinating, all the brain stuff and the science that's going into sort of revolutionizing this, it sounds like. Our Anchorage number, if you want to join us, is 907-550-8433. Toll free, we can be reached at 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, Beth, I want to go back to you for a minute before we get into some of these treatments and continue with, like, I can tell Dr. Hill is like a wealth of information. I could listen to it all day, but I do want to have you, can you briefly explain the different types of eating disorders? Because you talked about restrictive, and then we mentioned there's obsessive compulsive eating disorder. Can you talk just briefly about the different categories and
absolutely
how those manifest?
I'm sure Dr. Hill could do this well too, but I'll jump into this. The three main eating disorders that people think about are anorexia, which is restrictive, and it's a energy imbalance. So the idea, the myth in people's minds, the image people have is a very frail, thin, white, affluent teen. And in fact, eating disorders and anorexia affect people of all ages. And you can be at all weights and still experience restrictive eating. So that's anorexia in a nutshell. There's binge eating disorder, which is often it can be associated with restriction during the day or at some point. And then excessive eating sometimes is well planned out, but there's eating beyond the point where someone feels satisfied. And there's oftentimes shame associated with that binge. Bulimia is binge eating with compensatory behaviors such as vomiting or laxative use or excessive exercise. So those are the three large categories that people typically think of when they think about eating disorders.
All right. Dr. Hill, anything to add to that? Is she with us?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Can you hear me? I could not have said it better.
Okay.
Phew.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of pressure. You got an expert on the other end.
You got it.
All right. So before we took the break, another question for you, Beth, and you've answered this question before, and I've really enjoyed your answer. And this is something that, you know, how do people know, and Dr. Hill, you can add on to this, if it goes from, you know, I've heard the term disordered eating versus an eating disorder. What's the threshold or what's the point at which it moves from disordered eating, dieting, that sort of stuff, to an eating disorder?
I'll attempt, and again, Dr. Hill, jump in please after. But I think that many people have disordered eating because there's chronic dieting. As you mentioned, there's a lot of, you know, folks who are going from one diet to another. I think that when eating starts to disrupt your functioning, your ability to function and at home, at work, at school, in life, and it overtakes your life, and your thoughts are preoccupied with that exclusively, and you're not able to live a life fully. That's my layperson's description mm-hmm. of when it becomes an eating disorder. And so, Dr. Hill, I'm going to let you jump in on this as well.
Not so from inside out, and that is looking about our retina and our eyes. You may have some retinal aberrations, but you can say, I can see well enough without getting glasses. And then at some point, it's just too inconvenient. It's creating problems. I'm not able to read far away the traffic signs and things like that. So when it becomes problematic, I then get glasses. And just as Beth said, it's when the illness or the symptoms that are starting to show that those neural circuit aberrations are starting to create problems in one's life and ability to work and play and interact and just think through things, then therapy is needed in order to determine what you need to do to help compensate or what's going awry.
All right. So it sounds a lot like, what people talk about in the addiction field is, you know, there's abusive use of substances, and then there's a substance abuse disorder. And it really, there's a threshold at which it crosses, and it really interferes with your daily functioning. It occupies your time, your thought processes. You arrange your life around food, around meals, around avoiding, you know, you think about going to the going to a party, and you know, you're worried about the food that's going to be there and eating in front of people. So all those sort of, that when it just becomes that compulsive and preoccupation with it, it sounds like.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Dr. Hill, we're still having some breaking up of your phone thing, but I do want you to talk about, we'll give it a shot here, about TBTS. Like, can you explain to folks what that is, and how it's being used in the world of eating disorders?
Yes. I talked about earlier, and those traits come together and make our temperament, or a part, the biological side of our personality. And our traits are the areas that we began to look at and began to follow in the research, because they became the main nerves, the vagal nerve, so to speak, or a major highway to understanding the illness. So we started responding to all the results of the research, started putting that together, explaining that to our clients, and then saw how commonly the anorexia clients had common traits, the binge eating clients had some common traits, and that we began to start treating to those traits. But as Beth said earlier, eating disorders are not confined to adolescents. They often begin, and we now know why biologically they tend to begin during adolescence, but they evolve and continue to evolve through trait expressions through the rest of one's life, especially if you're not getting treatment to keep the illness from taking over one's life. So we developed and evolved with first treating to the neurobiological abnormalities, then the traits, and then we start the clients themselves. As I was forming treatment interventions that I'll be training, helping some supports learn when I'm there in Alaska, and then in the spring, helping clinicians all try on and use in their practices the very treatment tools. As I was trying them on with the clients, they would say, well, add this, and you've totally addressed my experience. So I would tweak it, and then I would run out to California and say, all right, research team, how close am I, or have I moved away from what the research is saying? And when the...
All right. Sounds like we lost Dr. Hill, but it sounds like a lot of this is taking science... I might have to have her back on another program to talk about this for a whole hour, because it sounds really fascinating. But one of the questions that maybe you can answer, one of the questions I had was, is this a treatment approach, a standalone approach, or is it something that works in conjunction with other modalities?
It is intended to work in conjunction with other modalities. So it augments treatments. And a big part of this, you mentioned TBTS, and so it's temperament-based treatment with supports. And the supports is really important. And part of that is making sure, and I hope that Dr. Hill will be on here soon, but, you know, I'm trying to adapt my language for supports, because this is a really exciting treatment augmentation, because what Dr. Hill was starting to speak about was, you know, we think about treatment being oftentimes for teenagers, and that is often the onset. TBTS really can work with all ages, and I think there's a real focus on adults who haven't really had treatment, and oftentimes parents are no longer necessarily in the picture, you know, if you're an adult still struggling with an eating disorder. But the idea of having supports being involved and being the glasses, I think that she'll talk about, supports can be, it can be a parent, but it could be a spouse, a partner, a roommate, a coworker. It could be an adult child. So it's someone helping provide that structure, and they're a critical part of this. So it, you know, your original question was, does it augment or does it stand alone? It does augment, and this is what we're considering this to be when Dr. Hill comes. She'll be here from September 19th through 23rd.
Okay.
And in four communities. But what will be really, this is sort of like an introduction because it's so complex. So Dr. Hill will also be a speaker on Project Echo. But this is going to be, give a sampling, an overview of what is the brain-based approach to eating disorder treatment. And when she's here, a primary part of what she's doing is working with those supports to say, okay, your loved one may have been struggling for years. How does this work to help them and help use their temperament to address eating disorders?
Yeah, how can we use these strengths of personality? She mentioned the stubbornness, the stick-to-itiveness, those things are strengths that we can build on to help people, you know, to apply them to battling this disease. And I think it's a really good point. Like, we think of the, you know, 90, 80 pound, 18-year-old white female, but it's men that have eating
exactly.
disorders, which are widely underdiagnosed, widely.
Very much.
And then adults who have probably not been identified either by themselves or by practitioners. We're dealing with other things and, focus. And nobody wants to talk about that.
Exactly. People of color and trans people.
Yeah, everybody.
Everybody who's overlooked because they don't fit the stereotype.
Yeah. So. And because many of them can't afford the swanky private treatment centers out of state.
And if I can just make a comment on that, you know, there's that perception of swanky in private, but if you think about this like an illness like cancer, you would get treatment for
yes.
that, and you would go wherever you needed to or wherever
right.
you could to save someone's life. And that is the situation, is that this becomes so disruptive. It's got the highest or second highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness, second to opioid addiction. And so it's highly serious.
That is a stat that shocked me when I read it. Like, that is, that's very serious. This is not just like somebody wanting to lose weight. This is potentially death.
Exactly. It affects every organ of the body. And suicidality is very high with this. I think that sense of being trapped, just like you talked about substance use disorders, there's that sense of not being in control. People think about this being a control, you know, like, oh,
right.
it's all about control. But with an eating disorder, you're seriously out of control. It's like, I like to say your brain is hijacked, and it's you're not thinking rationally.
Okay, we are up against our second break, so we're going to go ahead and take that, and then we'll come back and try to connect, see how our connection is with Dr. Hill. If you're just tuning into the program today, my guests are Beth Rose from the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance and International Eating Disorders Consultant Dr. Laura Hill. We are discussing the causes and some of the new treatments that are available and some community resources for eating disorders here in Alaska. If you'd like to share your thoughts, you have a question for my guest, please call us in the next 10 minutes or so we can get you on the air. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return for more of our conversation with Beth Rose and Dr. Laura Hill. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in today, my guests are Beth Rose from the Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance and International Eating Disorder Consultant, Dr. Laura Hill. We are talking about all things eating disorders, but mostly some of the treatment options and some of the consequences that come from this complex brain disease. If you have a question or a comment for us in Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Toll free, we're at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. I do have an email. I'm going to go ahead and read this, and we can let Dr. Hill take it. How, if she's there, how old is a child, or how old, at what age, should you begin to wonder if he or she has a serious eating disorder rather than what might be called a picky toddler?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I love that question because it is exactly within the frame of temperament-based therapy with support. And that is, if you are seeing your toddler be picky, avoiding eating, trying to, have... is not eating a wide variety of foods, wants to eat the same food over and over. Those are traits that could very much continue, if allowed to just roam free, continue to evolve. And then when that toddler hits adolescence, it moves to a whole new level. But those very traits can be... in fact, maximized right now while the child is a toddler and before puberty, and the child literally, it may take more effort to introduce another food. The child may end up eating two or three variations of something but not wanting something else. They may want only the sweet or the high-fat foods, but the fact is, the parent has the ability and can shape incredibly well an introduction into foods that are important for the child to eat, but not try to do a different food every day. Those who have a picky or restrictive tendencies want something and then need to do it over and over before they then introduce something else. The repetition goes right into with that food, but that's now a better food and a healthier food. So we work with the trait and actually shape it in a very healthy way.
Okay, so treatment for a child, at what age should a parent start to get concerned? It sounds like as a toddler you can recognize some of those traits, and then you start to use what you're talking about, shaping it and not activating that addictive sort of, it sounds very addictive. Eating disorders seem, very addictive, and the language and the way that they're activated. If you don't, if somebody doesn't drink until they're in their 20s or early 20s, they're much, and even if they have the sort of quote unquote addictive gene or those tendencies, they're much less likely to develop a substance abuse problem. That early exposure to substance abuse at 12, 13, 14 is a really high indicator, increasing the chances for a substance abuse problem. So at what age would you really like take them to somebody and explore the eating problem?
I think I would take them when it becomes a situation where the parents are literally feeling like they're banging their heads against the wall. They're feeling frustrated because they cannot get their child to respond, and the pickiness just becomes more pervasive. And the parent may look into talking with a dietitian to get ideas that are practical, everyday, easy, and start right from the get-go in working with somebody who has some experience. And the beauty is, now that we have virtual dietary services, you can maybe have access where you once might not have. So I would move right into it if the parent has lots of questions, so that the dietitian can then say, introduce this or introduce this and try this, and you just develop that layered approach, and you're not feeling you're alone, in a guessing game. But I would definitely be getting advice before puberty because, it, as I mentioned, that's when the hormones start to change, and it literally causes the genes to move to a stronger expression of those traits. And then it locks in into a way that is very hard and harder to treat, but it's still better to treat it then than to wait till 10 years later when the illness has continued to evolve.
That makes a lot of sense. As the child brain turns in, like starts to transition to the adult brain, things get more solidified and it gets more difficult to unlearn those things. All right, we have a phone call. I want to get to that. We have Jim, you're on line one from Talkeetna. Go ahead. Oh, Jim's gone, but maybe calling back. We're having some phone problems today. That's all right. Okay, so Beth, can you talk about prevalence? We haven't mentioned that. What are the, I mean, this is a high mortality mental health condition. And what kind of numbers are we talking about statistically?
Research that was conducted before the pandemic, and it could have gotten worse, this is by Harvard and by Deloitte, showed that 9% of people will have a clinically diagnosable eating disorder in their lifetime. And so we equate that to about 65,000 Alaskans. So there's a lot of folks who are not being diagnosed, that are struggling on their own, that feel like this is something they've caused. And it's happening in rural Alaska as well as in urban communities. And so it's one of the reasons that we are trying to work throughout Alaska to build awareness. We had somebody come up here in June to do an eating disorder boot camp, and that training is still available as an on-demand training for providers. But what our presenter, Jessica Setnick, said is that if you're a provider, you are seeing people with eating issues, and you're probably seeing people with eating disorders. And so it's really important to know how to ask questions, how to probe this. And unfortunately, we have a strong weight bias. There's a lot of weight stigma. And so oftentimes, even in the medical field, if someone sees someone losing weight, you know, a medical provider might say, "Wow, you look great. What's your secret?"
You're looking good.
Yeah, exactly. What's your secret? And then
I don't eat.
Yeah, right, exactly. But not knowing how right. to explore this. So it is a serious issue anywhere, and in a remote state like Alaska, it's especially problematic because people aren't being identified. And, you know, we're trying to encourage medical providers, mental health providers to learn even questions to ask, you know, questions to probe and allow it to be brought up in ways where, again, you destigmatize questions about eating issues.
I have so many questions coming to mind, and of course, people are starting to call at the end, which typically happens. So, Jessica and Chuyak, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I'm a physical therapist that works in pediatrics, and I work with a lot of occupational therapists that get referred around age 3-4 for picky eaters. And so typically it's the eaters you're talking about that want only chicken nuggets or one food item, and parents can't get them to eat anything else. And so that's just another, we work with dietitians in that regard as well, but I know a lot of occupational therapists also help with some of the picky eating starting young.
All right, well, that's good information that helps. It can, you know, starting to talk about food and encourage a variety of foods at an early age and not letting young kids get sort of locked into that. It's hard to get your kids to eat. Like, I got one of them that only wants to eat certain things, and it's tough to get her off that. Okay, Alex in Anchorage, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep, gotcha.
Okay, hey, thanks. Thanks for the show. I'm wondering if the prevalence of eating disorders, the increase in eating disorders that came with the early months of the pandemic, is still continuing here in Alaska. And if so, kind of, is it often in the teen population still, or has that moderated at all? And then I'm wondering what policy efforts are out there that could help improve services in Alaska. If you guys, I don't know if you guys already may have talked about that, but forgive me. So thanks.
Well, Alex, thanks for the question. This is Beth Rose, the one of the co-founders of Alaska Eating Disorders Alliance. We'd love to get you involved. We don't have a lot of good data. The data that we have comes nationally, and one of them was that during the pandemic, there was a 50% increase in hospitalizations for teenage females for eating disorders, specifically for anorexia. There has been an increase in eating disorders of all types. Here in Alaska, we only have anecdotal evidence and anecdotal information, and that is that more people are presenting with eating disorders. One of the areas that AKITA is working on is, and it's going to be a long-term goal or ongoing goal, is to increase access to health care for people with eating disorders. And especially for people on Medicaid, but we have that is a big issue and not something we've been able to do much with yet. So mostly, as we've mentioned, a lot of the focus is on growing capacity of the healthcare profession to address this issue in the state.
With the numbers at 10% almost of the population, are insurance companies paying for eating disorder treatment that you're aware of, or is it a diagnosis of bulimia or anorexia reimbursable like depression or anxiety is?
Yes, and there is parity in mental health care. There are certain criteria for anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder. Unfortunately, for hospitalization, some of the criteria don't always match the necessity because you may have to be underweight by a certain percent to get hospitalization. Even though you can be at a higher weight body and still experience all of the physical impacts of anorexia, but because you're not at that lower weight, it can be a problem getting hospitalization. And I'm not an insurance expert on this, but it's, there's actually a national organization also that will help with navigating that and help people find treatment based on the insurance that they have.
All right. Good information. I do want to get, we're almost out of time, but I want to read this and get a quick take, this email, because it's important, I think. My adult daughters are twin daughters are highly educated professionals, and over the years, their eating disorders have waxed and waned. On a recent visit, one twin's behavior was extremely different, and she was exhibiting signs of anorexia. In the past, she had bulimia. In addition, she drinks to excess. What can a mother do without offending to convey concern?
Dr. Hill, are you still on the line?
I've been there. I hope you can hear me.
Yep.
That is exactly why I'm coming to Alaska, and I hope you'll be able to be in one of those groups that AKITA is hosting, because your question is going to need more than a 15-second answer, and it's a very important, understandable question. So I hope I will get to meet you when I come to Alaska and help answer your question personally, because it is highly an important one for many mothers and of adult children. But I also want to say, just as this mother is concerned, just as I have been disconnected multiple times, that's not unlike therapy. You're with the client and suddenly they have to disconnect and, oh my gosh, what happens? What do I do and what do I say? Well, in this interview, Beth picked it right up and she was the support. And that's why temperament-based therapy acknowledges and recognizes and encourages the support, because without that support person, that and how to manage outside of therapy.
I gotta cut you off because we are out of time, but that's a great answer. My thanks to audio engineer Tobin Shelby and Ammon Swenson for producing today's program. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.